In effect from 11 a.m. until 8 p.m., critical fire weather conditions are expected and extreme fire behavior is possible. Right now, wind southwest at 16, gusting to 26, 65 degrees Kenosha, 64 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to have a conversation with a well-known writer who wrote a much-discussed piece in the New York Times several years ago in response to widespread criticism leveled at Disney for casting a young black actress as Ariel in their upcoming live-action remake of The Little Mermaid. We're going to be talking with Tracy Baptiste about her new children's book, which is called Mermaid and Pirate. In part two of today's program, we're going to be having a discussion about the Racine Theater Guild's upcoming production of Stand and Deliver, which tells the inspiring story of an extraordinary high school mathematics teacher, Jaime Escalante, and the spectacular success he achieved with inner city students. The play is based on the award-winning film of the same name. Here's part one of today's program. Well, I have a feeling that you have heard of a certain movie that is going to be made a little bit later this year, a live-action remake of the animated classic from Disney, The Little Mermaid. And can you believe that original film dates all the way back to 1989? And it is an exciting project. A lot of people are looking at it, are looking forward to it with great anticipation. Some notice has been given to some of the casting choices. One choice that has been made in the casting of this film is the casting of a beautiful young African-American woman named Halle Bailey in the title role of The Little Mermaid. And this has sparked a great deal of conversation. And one of the most spirited responses to that was an opinion piece in the New York Times from Tracy Baptiste. This is from several years ago. And maybe some of you saw this wonderful essay she wrote in response to some of the controversy over this casting choice. And the title of that essay was called Mermaids Have Always Been Black. And I think a lot of us who read that essay learned a lot. Tracy Baptiste, in a sense, is following up on that with a wonderful new children's book, which is one of a host of best-selling children's books that she has written over the years. And this is called Mermaid and Pirate. And it is an absolutely beautiful and enchanting book on so many levels. And we're going to be talking about that and also about the opinion piece which Tracy Baptiste wrote for the New York Times, which has been a very valuable contribution to the conversation swirling around this much anticipated film. And I'm excited to have Tracy Baptiste joining me via telephone for the next few minutes to talk in particular about her newest book, Mermaid and Pirate. Tracy Baptiste, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to be talking with you. Ahead of us talking about the central matters at hand, I think it would be really fun for our listeners to hear about how you found yourself into the world of children's books. And is this something that you dreamt about doing for quite a long time?
It is. When I was a kid growing up in Trinidad and Tobago, I had a huge number of books, and people also told stories. There were a lot of storytellers in my family, and just in general, Trinidad tends to be a place that really prioritizes storytelling. So from a really young age, I decided that I wanted to grow up and be a storyteller myself, and I really stuck with it as I got older. I did not know that I would be writing children's books necessarily, but when I moved to the United States at 15, I came across this great book by another Trinidadian author. Her name is Rosa Gee. The name of the book was The Friend, and it was about a girl about my age who had just moved to the Bronx from Trinidad, and it paralleled my experience pretty much exactly, because I had just moved to Brooklyn from Trinidad. And that's when I realized that I wanted to write children's books, because I wanted to elicit the same kind of connection with a book that I had when I read that. And that's really when my children's book writing journey began. I started trying to write picture books. It turns out that writing picture books is really hard, a lot harder than most people would expect. And I wound up writing novels for kids. And so that's really where I found my first success, was in writing novels for kids. Then I started writing picture books after I got, after I got to be a better writer, frankly. I was able to start writing picture books.
Fantastic. And, yeah, kind of the opposite of what we might...
Pirate.
Right. It's kind of the opposite of what we might assume.
Absolutely. It is, yeah. I think most people think that picture books are super easy because they are so simple, but because you have so few words to get out, all of these ideas that you need to get into a picture book, it really requires a very deft hand to be able to do it. And it took me a while to learn how to write picture books. But, now we have Mermaid and Pirate. I'm doing okay, I think.
Certainly are. If I remember correctly, you were an elementary school teacher, at least for a while. And I wonder what kind of benefit that was to you in terms of understanding children and ultimately understanding how to write effectively for them.
The big advantage, I think, in spending so much time with kids is you really understand what they're interested in, but also how quickly their attention can move to something else. So you learn pretty quickly and on your feet while you're standing in front of a classroom of, 30 young kids, that you have to be engaging. You have to be truthful to them. They really understand when you're kind of like holding back. And you also have to make sure that they have enough space to bring their own ideas into a conversation. And all of those things are really required in writing a children's book. Like, you really have to make sure that the book is engaging. You have to make sure that you are always holding the kids' attention, but you have to make sure that you are being honest in your writing, that the writing itself is not, not holding things back and not kind of talking down to kids, but also leaving enough space so kids can bring their own ideas to a story. And that really, is a skill that you have to learn. It is really quite different writing for kids than it is writing for adults. It is a very different kind of engagement that you need to be able to do. So, I think being a teacher, I taught pre-KK, second grade, and sixth grade. It really helped me to figure out how to be honest with kids and write stories that they would enjoy.
Hmm. We're speaking with Tracy Baptiste. Her latest book for children is called Mermaid and Pirate. So I've already touched on the fact that not long after the announcement was made about at least much of the cast for this live-action remake of The Little Mermaid, the fact that a young African-American woman had been cast in the role of Ariel touched off a great deal of discussion and even controversy in some quarters. And it prompted you to write the aforementioned opinion piece for The New York Times titled Mermaids Have Always Been Black. Tell us a little bit about your response to what was being said about this film and this casting choice and how you wanted to respond to it. What was most important for you to say? Because I think that also speaks to the way in which you shaped this wonderful new children's book.
Oh, yeah, thank you. So I think that because a lot of storytelling has really focused on Western, specifically European American white stories, that people just don't realize that there are a vast world of stories out there that feature characters of all of these, you know, of color from all over the world. So the first thing that was really surprising to me was when people were saying things like, a mermaid cannot be black, which is ridiculous because we live on a planet where there is, you know, so much water and water touches all of the, you know, these lands, and, you know, land is not exclusive to, you know, the seawater is not exclusive to white countries. So that was the first part that was really ridiculous. But I also happened to know in my research that, because I, you know, I really am interested in fantasy creatures just in general, but I happened to know that in my research I found black mermaids in cave drawings in South America, stories about Asian mermaids in places like China and Japan and India, brown mermaids in South America. So there were mermaids from all over the world, and it just so happened that people did not know about these mermaids. So that was really the first thing, was the idea that a mermaid could only be white was the first thing that needed to be dispelled, because people just did not have this information. That was one part of it. But then the other part was that, you know, it's a fantasy character, right? I mean, mermaids are not real, so, you know, they can really be cast by absolutely anyone. It really doesn't matter what the mermaid looks like, so long as the mermaid, you know, plays the role of Ariel to, you know, and does, like, a really great job of it. So I'm sure that when Disney was casting, they were just really looking for the best person to play this particular character. But then the other part was that, okay, well, then why is Ariel the only mermaid story that we have when there are so many other mermaid stories from all over parts of the world, right? So it really was all three of those things that I was trying to convey in that one essay.
Hmm. So tell us this, the genesis of this lovely new children's book. And by the way, I hope you'll also mention the talented illustrator who has really created some spectacular visuals for it. But this new children's book called Mermaid and Pirate. It is a very lightly populated book. That is, it's essentially just the mermaid and the pirate. We see maybe one other person, but it is a very, very compelling story. Tell us how you kind of put it together.
Thank you. So it was after I wrote that op-ed for The New York Times, my editor asked if I would write a black mermaid story. You know, I had been talking about the idea that, you know, Ariel was not the only mermaid story that was out there. And so she thought that I would be the right person to take this on, since I had done all of this research into black mermaid, black and brown mermaid characters. And, you know, I was happily able to take that on. And my idea really came from these two toys that I had in my office. My office is very you know, populated with a lot of toys. And one day I happened to have a stuffed mermaid and a plush pirate sitting next to each other on a chair. And I thought, oh, you know, what would happen if these two characters met? Like, obviously they wouldn't speak the same language because they come from two different worlds. You know, what would that look like? And so that's really how mermaid and pirate started, with the idea that, you know, if they met and they could not communicate but needed to communicate, what would that look like? And so the book has all of this pirate talk, a lot of like arg and grr kind of sounds, but also has a lot of mermaid talk where she kind of, you know, talks in this kind of bubbly language where she like says glub and lub and bubbity and things like that. So the two of them can, you know, like attempt to communicate with each other, but it's all brought together with these beautiful illustrations by Liesl Adams. So Liesl very much understood that a lot of mermaid and pirate's communication would have to be nonverbal, and she was able to get just the perfect expressions in their faces, expressions of frustration when they first meet each other because there's this storm that whips up and literally crashes the two of them together, and expressions of amusement as, you know, they like trying to communicate with each other, and they you know, are having a little bit of difficulty doing that, expressions of, you know, fear or disappointment at different times in the story. She was able to capture all of that while giving us this absolutely beautiful color world with these corals and sea anemones and fish and seahorses. It really is just absolutely gorgeously illustrated by Liesl Adams. She did such an amazing job. I could not be happier with the illustrations.
I certainly agree. And I love the fact that this book has these two principles, the mermaid and the pirate, really being equals, and they're each helping the other. She is not the helpless damsel in distress being rescued by the pirate, but it really goes in both directions. They are both helping each other, saving each other, and it ends up being a most intriguing and beautiful friendship.
It does. You know, it was a lot of fun to put Mermaid in trouble and have Pirate kind of bail her out, and put Pirate in trouble and have Mermaid bail him out. That was the biggest fun for me, was seeing like what kind of trouble these two characters could get into and how they could be kind to each other and then form this friendship. Because, of course, when they first meet, they're really quite frustrated with each other because they are just, you know, like they really just, it is 100% a meet cute and not like the cutest meet cute.
Right.
Where they just are thrown together and they're like really so angry. But then they immediately start trying to help each other out because they both find themselves in two difficult positions, and they form a friendship because they learn to trust each other because the other one has been kind to them. And it is very much a story of friendship and kindness and learning how to get along despite differences.
The book is Mermaid and Pirate, published by Algonquin Young Readers, and Tracy Baptiste, the author. Congratulations on a lovely book, and best wishes with all of your future projects.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD, FM 91.1. I'm Gregory Berg. The time is 8:30. In part two of today's program, I'm delighted to be reconnecting with a friend and colleague, Edson Melendez, who spends his hourly days at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, but has been spending night after night after night after night at the Racine Theater Guild as director of their production of Stand and Deliver, which is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild, based on the true story of an extraordinary high school math teacher, Jaime Escalante, who taught at James A. Garfield High School in East Los Angeles and achieved astounding success with, shall we say, an unlikely group of students, I mean, from whom one would not necessarily expect great success at this high level in matters like calculus. And what Mr. Escalante was able to achieve was immortalized, if you will, in the award-winning film Stand and Deliver, and now this play adaption by Roger Bella is about to be performed at the Racine Theater Guild. And Edson Melendez has been serving as stage director for this production and joins us in the middle of what I know is an incredibly busy and intense final week of rehearsals before the play opens this Friday night. And it's a play that runs just the next two weekends. So if you are intrigued by the story of Stand and Deliver, you don't want to delay in getting your tickets in order to see this production. Edson Melendez, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to see you again, and great to be on the morning show and say hello to everybody out there.
And I appreciate you making time for this during what I'm sure is just a back-breaking week, the final week, sometimes called Hell Week, of rehearsals for any production is challenging indeed. And I know for a lot of different reasons this is quite a challenging production, but it sounds like you have the end in sight, and you have a show that you're excited to share with the public.
Yeah, it's an absolutely wonderful show and a very poignant show, but it's also very funny. You know, it captures, because we're dealing with high school students, it captures the energy of youth. And it's just a very enjoyable show that people may not expect the lighter elements of. The week has been, you know, it's challenging. You're at the theater till midnight, night after night. And I also have a job during the day. So I'm there by, 7:30, 8 o'clock every morning. So I don't sleep much.
Well, we wish you good night's sleep once this production has opened. And again, it opens this coming weekend and runs for two weekends. Let's first of all find out about your own acquaintance with the story of Stand and Deliver. I suspect, like most of us, you probably saw the film. Assume that was your introduction to Jaime Escalante and his story.
Absolutely. I saw the film probably back in middle school, so just a few years after it was made, and loved it. It kept coming back into my life. It kept being an example for others, that I recommended. And it has the amazing Edward James Olmos, who is one of the top actors in the history of the profession, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And nominated for an Oscar, I think, for his performance, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It absolutely was. He was nominated, and the film did win several awards, but not at that level.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we should circle back to the actual Jaime Escalante and talk a little bit about the actual story which ultimately inspired a book and then the film and ultimately this play. So tell us what you know about the real-life Jaime Escalante.
Well, basically all of the same stuff that is in the show. He was an immigrant from Bolivia. He came here, quite educated, and nobody recognized that education. Nobody accepted that education here in the United States. So he had to basically redo his education and worked, several jobs to do that and support a family as well. And then he went and got this job at Garfield High School in East Los Angeles and was just a powerhouse, changed the dynamic of not only the thoughts that the institution had, but the community at large. So he was a very, very influential person, and I hope he ends up in the annals of history, you know, along with Chavez and some of those other people who really helped Chicano culture move forward.
Hmm. So explain what he achieved at James A. Garfield High School, which had never been achieved before, and we should add, has not been achieved since.
So what he did at Garfield was that he came in, and there was what, in essence, was a remedial math class. And he pushed those students and pushed the school to allow him to teach more elevated math, algebra, and then ultimately calculus at a collegiate level. And with all of that, he had to fit all of that into sort of a two-year period with this specific class. And he ended up doing that. They ended up taking the California Advanced Placement Test, which was a very, very rare thing even for people to attempt, much less to actually pass. And the majority of the students that he was dealing with actually ended up passing that. In fact, so much so that they had the most passing grades from any high school across California, which is a sizable state, in the history of the examination.
Wow. and again, this is not a typical kind of Beverly Hills or Hollywood kind of school with that sort of clientele. We're talking about what sounds like, at least in many respects, an inner city high school and a population to match. And so we're talking about an achievement that's even more extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. The community around there was, you know, early 1980s Chicano community, many first generation students with parents who just wanted them to get through high school, many people who were involved in gang activities, those that were trying to move past that had grown up around it. So, it is a marginalized population that he was dealing with, and a very low economic community as well as the resources that the institution had. You know, they didn't have money because they were in that low economic community. So they didn't even have the correct equipment or the correct curriculum or books, things of that nature that they needed to be successful.
Hmm. So as far as you know, in terms of real life and also in terms of what we see in the play, what was the key to Mr. Escalante's extraordinary success? I mean, what did he do? What did he bring to this nearly insurmountable task that allowed him and his students, of course, to succeed so spectacularly?
Well, as he says in the play quite consistently, ganas. And ganas means the willingness, the effort, the hard work needed to accomplish these things. He says it in the play, but more so than that is a belief that the community does not have to be locked into those stereotypes and those labels that it's been given by society. It can stand on its own merit and move forward if it believes in itself. So a kind of belief in one's own ability outside of the labels that are handed to you by society. And that I think was the key, being able to convince people that they don't need to adhere to those labels. They don't need to adhere to the things that other people have put on them. They can move forward, and they do have validity. They have validity that could help move the community forward. I think those are the things that really drive not only the show and the movie, but the real story as well.
Hmm. Do you think it made any difference in the real life Escalante that he was also an immigrant, that he didn't grow up in Los Angeles, in a sense, steeped in those assumptions and stereotypes that are so easy to make? I mean, he came into this scenario, in a sense, very much as an outsider, and maybe with a fresh perspective. Is that possible?
I think so. I think the efforts that he made to get to where he was and had to make the, you know, having to redo some education and also coming from an educated background and having to deal with, you know, society basically telling him we don't do that in this country. I think that helped. I think it helped understand some of the community. I think it helped understand some of the background and some of the thoughts that perhaps the parents didn't even believe in. So it definitely was useful. But more than that, I think it was his own drive, his own willingness, his own desire, and his own inspiration.
Mm. I've also read, I haven't read extensively, but I've read a little that makes mention of his interesting sense of humor, and yeah, that apparently he brought that to bear in the classroom quite a lot. Is that something we see in the play, Stand and Deliver?
Absolutely. We see him playing with this class consistently. The class itself is not exactly welcoming when he first arrives. They don't care. They don't want him there. They really couldn't care more or less about the class. And because the community is a little rough and the students are a little rough and tumble, he goes along with that. He plays into their lives, into the sense of humor that that is already existent there. He calls them burros, which means donkeys. Mm. He says crazy stuff to them like, you know, I'll tattoo your chromosomes and, you know, just things that are really non-expected and probably shouldn't be said by teachers to a student, definitely would not be said these days by an educator to students.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Edson Melendez, and we're talking about the production, which he is directing at the Racine Theater Guild, of Stand and Deliver. So, of course, based on the well-known film, the screenplay of Roman Menendez and Tom Muska, adapted for the stage by Roger Bella. The play at the Guild opens this weekend and will run for two consecutive weekends. So tell us about the opportunity that came your way to direct this production.
Well, I was sitting around and I got a call from Doug Instance. I'm never going to be able to say his name correctly, but a great man. He gave me a call and he said, "Hey, Edson, you know, we're doing this show. We really want to make sure that we have somebody from the culture that understands and is respectful and knows the culture intimately." And so he offered me the opportunity to direct this. And I said, yes, almost immediately. I had to move a couple things around, and you know, I couldn't say no to something like that.
I wonder, is this the first thing you've directed at the Guild?
This is the first thing I've directed as a Guild. Several years ago, I was an actor there for a show called Sherlock Holmes, The Last Adventure, and I played Professor Moriarty. Mm. you know, and that was a wonderful experience with the Guild, and this has also been just an absolute pleasure. The people who are involved there, from the administration to the volunteers, the passion that they have, the respect that they have for the art form, and really the professionalism that they show in terms of how they operate there is absolutely astounding. And I don't think that there's probably any other community theater in the nation that could rival the level of performance and love that you feel from RTG.
Hmm. So this is you were telling me, a cast of 13, eight of whom are students of Mr. Escalante in the story of Stand and Deliver. Tell us a little bit about the special challenge of working with so many young people in a cast like this, and in particular, a cast in which, if I understood you correctly, at least some of these young people are relatively inexperienced on the stage. So just talk about the challenges that has represented for you.
Well, you know, productions are always a little bit challenging as you get to know the cast and things of that nature. But the original play, the script, calls for over 22 people. And we had to pare that down to 13. So we had to figure out who can play multiple characters and how we do that, how we change them enough so that it's not incredibly obvious. And in terms of having, you know, the younger cast, we do have some people who are relatively inexperienced. I think there are a couple who this perhaps is their first stage production. And they rose to the occasion. It's a little bit of work in terms of the stage craft. You know, those things about, you know, staying open or taking the stage. And RTG has a very interesting setup. So there's a little bit of challenge there. They didn't always understand that. Also, they didn't always fall into a role the way a professional actor might, where, you know, they assume somebody, the self of somebody else. It was a little showy at first, and they just, by now, they've dropped all of that, and they've really become very, very strong performers. And I didn't change much in terms of my communication or anything like that. It was just wonderful to see the growth that they've had. And some of them should, you know, I would say, had they wanted to, if they wanted to, could probably cross into the realm of professional actors.
Wow. So who are the other five characters? Of course, one of them is Mr. Escalante, this incredible teacher. Otherwise, who else do we meet?
So we meet some administrators who are Ortega and Molina. Molina is the principal. Ortega is the chair of the math department there. And, you know, they're both struggling with the school. The school is, you know, put on academic probation and could be shut down. And so they're dealing with all those types of issues. The other thing, the other people that we meet is a representative from the Educational Testing Board of California, who really is there to say, hey, this was cheating on the test when they achieved the test the first time. This was cheating, and find out how and why and all of that. And not entirely unsupportive, but not really supportive of the things that were going on in the achievement level. We also have a kind of leader of a gang. His name is Chuco, and a smaller character played by the same actor, actually, that has probably been through that a little bit and is now trying to turn their lives around.
Mm. So, how, as someone who from the Latino community, it sounds like you feel really good about this work. That is, I mean, because there's a number of ways that one can tell this story, and including ways that might fall into familiar tropes and stereotypes and so on. And but it sounds like you feel good about the authentic way in which this play, like the film, seeks to tell this story. Is that right?
Absolutely. This play gives us the opportunity to really understand the characters, to meet them in a different, more intimate way. They all have a monologue that tells us a little bit more about their background. The movie presents everything in a sort of all the characters being in this really Chicano, almost, almost gang type situation. And what we were able to do is represent other areas of that community. You know, people who are more or raised in the more conservative side, people of other cultures who are actually involved, because there aren't any isolated communities across the country. It gave us the option to examine more individually and, you know, really understand more of the diverse characters that make up the tapestry of a community like that.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me before we went on the air that you made the directorial choice to move the events of the play a little bit later into the sort of the historic arc. Tell us exactly where you are setting the production and why you made that choice.
So we are setting the production in the early 1990s. So it's moving it up about 10 years. Now, that was done for a few reasons. One of them is that we have a cast that some of them are quite young, and already the 90s is, you know, way back in the days for them. It is very removed from their lives now and from something that they, you know, naturally understand. So that helped us get at least a little bit closer, some more relevant references, some more understandable elements, because their parents may have been there and could tell them a little bit more about what it was like in the early 90s. The other reason was because in the early 90s, there was this explosion of Chicano culture in Texas and in California, and we're seeing big stars happening for the first time that are spreading across the country, in particular Selena, who, you know, kind of was the biggest champion and a hero in the community. So there was a big conversation happening in the country around Latino issues and around Latino culture becoming part of the American lexicon. And, you know, it was really the beginning of the weaving that now is very, very much part of American popular culture with artists like Pitbull and Bad Bunny and other, you know, other artists, Jennifer Lopez, Mark Anthony, who are part of our everyday pop conversations that represent our culture. So that was very, very important. And I think the early 1990s and the reality of that from the early 1990s was a choice that that just focused a little bit more specifically on the advancement of the culture.
Hmm. I've read that the play is essentially set in the classroom. I mean, that's pretty much entirely where we are for the whole play. Is that right?
Sort of. Obviously, the challenges of doing a stage production are different than film. We don't have the luxury of moving wildly from location to location that are very different. A good chunk of the show is in the classroom. The classroom, however, is built on a model of the classrooms in California, where the hallway is not a true hallway the way we think of it here in Wisconsin. What it is the hallway is usually an outdoor corridor with, you know, a lot of concrete and things of that nature. So we're able to blend those elements so that we can use the concrete sections to create a different space, to create a different environment and a different feeling from what happens specifically in the classroom. And there are interactions that are quite important, you know, a couple of fights and things of that nature, little pockets of people hanging out before or after class. And, you know, people don't really hang out at school after class. You want to go home. So there we have the opportunity to experience them outside of the classroom and to give various characters and various situations their own life removed from the classroom.
So we are in the last week of rehearsals. So for instance, what was happening last night? At what point are you in this final entry towards opening night?
Well, we are running the show, and unless there are catastrophes, we attempt not to stop. Last night was a lot of tech, so coordination of lights with sound. There's quite a bit of sound, you know, obviously changing locations requires quite a bit of light changes and things of that nature, and many of them happen simultaneously. So just the coordination, there are, you know, what people don't understand is that there are tons of people involved. You have sound designer, light designer, who is Davidson Kane, and Jenny Bauer, who are just absolutely brilliant. And then we have light techs. So during the actual show, you have somebody else running the lights and somebody else running the sound. And then we have our stage manager who is calling the show. So, you know, there's people on headset and they say, light cue this, light sound cue that, you know, stand by, go. So it is much bigger production on the back end than people might realize. The magic of theater is not true magic. People have to make the magic happen. So that was a lot of the coordination stuff is what we've been working out and what we were doing most recently. And then tonight, I'm confident that everything will go, just swimmingly and, we still deal with taking notes for the characters and giving notes. This scene, we need to stay a little bit more open, or working very small and very detailed parts of their interactions with one another.
Hmm. So how does it feel doing something like this versus what I think is your first love, which is the world of opera? And I know you've directed a fair amount of opera and certainly performed in opera. What does this feel like? Does this feel like a very close cousin to that, or does this feel like a very, very different, dramatically different undertaking?
It is very different. It is very different. Not on the coordination, technical end of stuff. Those processes are shared by basically all theatrical art forms. What is different about it is the ability to explore. And to take different choices in opera, which is, my true background, a lot of it is dictated to you by the music. You don't have the ability to all of a sudden say something in a hushed tone to be jarring. You have to do what the composer says. Not that there isn't room for exploration, within that. There's still tons of room for exploration within that. You don't have a conductor. In opera, it is really a team effort between a stage director and a conductor. For this type of show, you don't have, an orchestra in front of you. But mostly it is the style in which you can direct. You have to be aware in a different way about the interactions between the characters specifically and the crafting of, their monologues and, the beats that we need to add in theater that are by nature added in already for you in opera. So it is a different challenge, and it is incredibly enjoyable to watch how actors can make decisions that you're just not expecting. Helping make that something that is cohesive, that does run across the show, that builds an arc without breaking the show. It is a different challenge, but it's extremely enjoyable.
So the play once again is Stand and Deliver, and it opens this Friday night at the Racine Theater Guild. And it runs for just 2 weekends. So time is dwindling away for you to get your tickets. And to do so, you can call the Racine Theater Guild's box office at 262-633-4218. Or you can go to their website, which is racinetheater.com or .org. I'm trying to remember now.
.com.
To get more information about tickets for
Stand and Deliver. There's another way to get tickets as well, and that's by calling the UW Parkside theater or box office. They've teamed up with their continuing education programs, and they're actually hosting a reception at the Worcester Museum, which is on the same campus as RTG, which involves some light appetizers and a director's talk before the show.
Ah, and so when will that be?
That'll be on the 14th, and that event begins at 5 o'clock. The ticket price includes that. The price of the ticket does include all of those elements when you buy it through the box office at UW Parkside.
Very good. So Stand and Deliver at the Racine Theater Guild, and the director of this production, Edson Melendez. Edson, it's been great to talk with you today, and congrats on all of the hard work that you have put into this production, you and the cast and crew for Stand and Deliver, and we wish you a very, very successful run of performances of this really important and inspiring play.
Well, thank you for having me on again in this context, and as always, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we look forward to the monthly visit of our good friend Nan Calvert. And We're going to be joined by John Holloway, who is the chairman of the town of Paris, and we're going to be talking with Mr. Holloway about some of the plans which are underway to help